protesters being removed from outside of Mitch McConnell's office. You can see many of them are in wheelchairs.
Oh, lovely. Protesters in wheelchairs being removed.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
I'm tired of all this winning.
I got a feeling there's something right.
Things are just getting better and better.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., in Oregon on 91.7 FM KYAQ on the Central Coast, 106.7 FM Queso in Cottage Grove, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania on 92.9 FM WLRI, in Maui, Hawaii on 88.5 FM KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN 94.1 FM, Palinville, New York's 102.9 FM WLPP, Grand Rapids, Michigan's WPRR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We're also heard streaming coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR, Revolution 99, Deprogrammed Radio, Detour Talk, and Radio Sputnik, amongst other fine affiliates across this planet. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. Coming up, remember when U.S. Army intelligence analyst Bradley Manning, now Chelsea Manning, released all of those documents and videotapes on the U.S. Apache helicopter pilots gunning down people, including Reuters journalists in Baghdad, Iraq, all of those years ago? And all of those other documents from the Afghanistan war and those diplomatic cables released via WikiLeaks years ago. Remember how we were told that the leak of those documents had deadly consequences for Americans and their allies in the so-called war on terror? Well, all of these years later, we finally get a look at the intelligence community's damage assessment of Chelsea Manning's leaks, thanks to BuzzFeed journalist and Freedom of Information Act champion Jason Leopold. He'll be joining us momentarily to discuss what the documents that he was finally able to shake out of the federal government actually tell us about all of that, even as Manning has finally been released early after seven years of imprisonment from her 35-year sentence, thanks to a commutation late last year by then President Obama. Remember him, Desi Doyen?
Yes.
It was, seems like a long time ago.
Forever ago.
It really does. Anyway, I'm looking forward to catching up with Jason on that and other matters shortly. And no, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to take Trump's bait today. His tweet that he put out shortly after the release of the Senate GOP's secret health care bill, I'm not going to take the bait. Maybe we'll later I'll take the bait, but not now.
I'm not going to.
Now we finally see, now that the Republicans have released in the Senate their secret health care bill, we see just a few of the reasons why the GOP has been hoping to keep this thing quiet, keep this thing a secret in the Senate for as long as possible. It is not good. But as the League of Women Voters described it in a statement shortly after the release, the Better Care Reconciliation Act, that's what they're calling it, the Better Care Reconciliation Act, is even worse than the version that we saw pass in the House of Representatives and is not worthy of this great nation. The cuts to Medicaid will be massive and will destroy the system that so many Americans rely on. This is a nasty bill that will hurt millions of Americans, and we urge senators to reject it. This is the League of Women Voters coming out and using language like this. You know, usually quite staid organization to be using language like this. They say it is not at all surprising that this bill is a terrible one. The legislation developed in secret and rushed to passage is usually trying to hide something. Like the House bill, they say the Senate plan will cut coverage and raise costs for millions of Americans while giving a huge tax breaks, a huge tax break to the wealthiest individuals and large corporations. The senators who wrote this bill should be ashamed of themselves, according to the League of Women Voters. But before the bill was even released today, Capitol Hill police were forcibly forcibly removed protesters, many of them who were elderly themselves and in wheelchairs, from outside the hallway of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's office at the Capitol, amid chants of no cuts to Medicaid. In the minutes after Senate Republicans released the text of their bill, all hell sort of broke loose there in the hallway, and they started hauling these people off in their wheelchair.
I know. That's what's really dramatic about this video, is these people are in wheelchairs, some of them severely disabled.
They were captured on video picking up and removing protesters from the hallway as others chanted behind them. Three officers were carrying each protester down the hallway, these old men, these old women, one of whom continued to chant even as the police removed him. They were staging a die-in against the bill outside of McConnell's office. The Senate bill proposes deeper long-term cuts to Medicaid than its House predecessor, amid other concerns about the new secretly drafted legislation that even most Senate Republicans had not been allowed to see until today. And remember, this was supposed to be the nicer version with heart, as Donald Trump keeps calling it. He called the House bill that he celebrated when it passed, he called that mean. He said he wanted a bill with more heart coming out of the Senate. So more heart apparently means more cuts to Medicaid that is going to directly affect the elderly.
Oh, directly harm, not just the elderly, but people who are disabled and children, especially children who are born with, you know, important, very difficult birth defects.
Yep.
And you know, I think it's 2 out of every 3 people in nursing homes.
Yep. That's exactly what it is. We talked about that a little earlier this week. Yeah, a lot of people think of Medicaid as something that is a program for the poor. But a huge tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of elderly end up having to use Medicaid to pay for nursing home care near the end of their lives. Nonetheless, Republicans are now many of them actually supporting this bill, incredibly enough. Democrats, as you might have predicted, they're against it. Senator Bernie Sanders was, I think, the first out of the gate condemning this bill, calling it worse than expected. He said, for weeks, Republicans have been drafting their health care bill in secret, refusing to hold hearings or publicly debate it. Now we know why. The bill Republicans announced today is even worse than expected and by far the most harmful piece of legislation I have seen in my lifetime. That's my Bernie Sanders. This bill has nothing to do with health care, he said in his statement. It has everything to do with an enormous transfer of wealth from working people to the richest Americans. Republicans want to throw millions of Americans off of health insurance, says the senator, including thousands of Vermonters, slash Medicaid, defund Planned Parenthood, and substantially increase premiums on older Americans. Meanwhile, he says their bill would provide over $200 billion in tax breaks to the top 2% and hundreds of billions more to the big drug and insurance companies that are ripping off the American people. Sanders went on to say, our job now is to rally millions of Americans against this disastrous bill to make sure it does not pass the Senate. Instead of throwing tens of millions of Americans off of health insurance, we must guarantee health care as a right to every American. Sanders, of course, was hardly the only Democrat to come out with guns a-blazing against this bill today. Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut, for example, tweeted, "No tweaks by amendment can fix this monstrosity. If you vote for this evil, intellectually bankrupt bill, it will ruin millions of lives." Ezra Klein of Vox.com summed up the GOP Senate's Better Care Reconciliation Act in one sentence, quote, poor people pay more for worse insurance. adding, "It's not complicated, it's just cruel." Health expert Larry Leavitt tweeted similarly. He said, "Under the Senate bill, low-income people would pay higher premiums for bigger deductibles." Leavitt of the Kaiser Family Health Foundation later explained, "In broad strokes, the Senate bill is just like the House. Big tax cuts, big cut in federal health spending, big increase in the uninsured." Or as Ezra Klein explained in more detail, describing the cuts to current Obamacare premium subsidies and cuts to requirements for the plans that are offered on the Affordable Care Act exchange, he said, "Low-income Americans get less money to buy crummier insurance." Other than that, Trump's promise for a plan that is less mean than the House GOP's version, that has more heart, it's going great. Much less, by the way, don't forget, he said that Trump had promised over and over again that his health care plan would be better, would be less expensive health care for more people. So far, neither the House nor the Senate plan seem to offer what the president has repeatedly promised. It does not seem to be borne out in this Senate bill, which is, in fact, in many ways worse than the House version. Specifically, the bill would impose deeper long-term cuts to Medicaid than the House version would. It would eliminate the bulk of the Affordable Care Act's taxes on wealthy people, so they're going to get their money back, and it will offer tax credits for individual insurance plans that are technically more generous than the House versions, particularly for lower-income people, but still far stingier than the subsidies that are available under the current law, under the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. The Better Care Reconciliation Act comes after 2.5 months of secret closed-door GOP-only negotiations. Remember, the same Republican Party that had complained that when there were dozens of hearings over the Affordable Care Act under Obama and a year-long public process, they complained at that time that it was being rammed down our throats. Now they are doing far worse. They are talking about that, there could be changes still to this bill, but they are hoping to bring it to a vote just next week, that quickly.
Now, to put this in perspective, during the run-up to Obamacare, they had 25 days of debate on the Senate floor. Here we're going to have, at best, at most, 20 hours.
Nonetheless, all of this signals an approach that largely sticks to the House Republican legislation. That legislation, the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, had said would result in 23 million fewer people having health coverage. That plan shortchanges the government assistance in health coverage, particularly for lower income people, passes on to the states the decisions on how to make up for the shortfall here. The Obamacare Medicaid expansion would still be wound down under the Senate plan as it was in the House bill, but it will be done so more gradually. The so-called transition phase would be longer under the Senate version, starting in 2021, with the federal match rate for the expansion for those who have the expanded population of Medicaid being reduced over time until 2024. To appease the right-wingers who don't like this longer period of funding Medicaid expansion, the Senate bill introduces steeper cuts to the traditional Medicaid program. Like the House bill, the GOP Senate bill will transform the program from its current unlimited rate, unlimited match rate. In other words, whatever you needed if you were on Medicaid would be paid for by the federal government. We're doing away with that in this bill. And states instead will be given a limited amount of money per enrollee in the program each year. If those people run out of money, too bad for those people. The tax credits that the bill offers sticks to the Affordable Care Act model in allowing them to scale with age and income. The House bill only dealt with age. However, it cuts the subsidies off at the 350% of the federal poverty line. So if you make more than 350% of the federal poverty line, you'll get nothing here. Instead, the Affordable Care Act had gone all the way up to 400% of the federal poverty line. That's the current law. And even that was not enough. That should likely be expanded to a lot of people who still cannot afford insurance. And yet the Republican bill is going to make it worse. It also resets the percentage of medical costs that insurers must cover in the basic plans on the exchange. Instead of the ACA's 70% of costs, under the new bill, only 58% of those costs will be covered. Larry Levitt of the Kaiser Foundation says the Senate bill shifts the subsidies so that younger people will pay less and older people will pay a lot more as a percentage of income. The language released on Thursday also bars the use of federal tax credits for any health insurance plans that cover abortion, as did the House, I believe. And the bill also defunds Planned Parenthood, where many tens of thousands of women get their health care there.
That's wrong. Millions of women get their health care there. For many women, Planned Parenthood is their only actual health care provider that they see on any regular basis. Yep. This is extremely damaging to women.
And one of those women who you might expect would be not very happy about this bill was Elizabeth Warren, the senator from Massachusetts. And, you know, she talked as well about how Medicaid is, you know, is seen by many as only for poor people. But in fact, more than one in three, I think almost two in three, I think you had it right, of elderly Americans ends up needing Medicaid in order to pay for nursing home care. That was just one of the points Senator Elizabeth Warren talked about in her fiery speech today on the floor of the U.S. Senate.
Today, we finally got a look at the monstrosity of a bill that the Republicans have been hiding behind closed doors for weeks. And it's pretty clear now exactly who they were working for. This bill has one flashing neon sign after another telling us who the Republican Party cares about, and it is not American families. The Senate bill is crammed full with just as many tax cuts as the House bill. How to pay for all those juicy tax cuts for their rich buddies? I'll tell you how. Blood money. Medicaid is the program in this country that provides health insurance to one in five Americans, to 30 million kids, to nearly two out of every three people in a nursing home. These cuts are blood money. People will die. Let's be very clear. Senate Republicans are paying for tax cuts for the wealthy with American lives.
That was Senator Elizabeth Warren calling it blood money. Strong language, but true. Remember, back in January, Mitch McConnell, the majority leader for the Republicans, was complaining about Obamacare that there were still 25 million Americans who aren't covered by it, saying that their plan was going to cover more people. Well, we'll see the Congressional Budget Office score next week, but it is unlikely this plan is going to cover more people than Obamacare. And yet you got folks on the conservative right in the Senate Republican caucus who say this does not go far enough. Senator Rand Paul and three other Republicans say they oppose the bill as it is currently written, though they suggested that changes could be made that will win their support. No doubt. We will be talking about all of this, I suspect, in the days ahead as they work towards passage next week before the July 4th holiday. In the meantime, the secret process under which that health care bill in the Senate was created, that is not the only secret process going on right now in Washington, D.C. And it's not only under this administration that secrecy and the overclassification of information has long been a problem. We're only now learning what damage, for example, that thousands of documents released by Chelsea Manning way back in 2010 has or hasn't caused. That story and more with FOIA terrorist Jason Leopold is straight ahead on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't go away.
Hey.
Dirty little secrets. The government seems to have quite a few of them. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Let me start here. Senior White House correspondent Jim Acosta railed against a lack of transparency in the Trump administration on Thursday after an apparent White House decision to bar television cameras from recording a normal White House press briefing. In a series of tweets today, Acosta noted that the White House had refused to allow cameras to record today's briefing, consequently taking away voters' ability to see and hear what they're doing. Acosta tweeted, "I'm off today, but it must be said that your White House is taking away your right to see and hear your government answer questions today." The White House, he said, is holding what is essentially a normal briefing in the briefing room, but they aren't allowing cameras to record what's being said. Acosta also said that while pen and pad gaggles are common, where, you know, they just meet with reporters off camera, the White House, in this case, their refusal to hold on-camera press briefings is different. It's a briefing without the cameras. Why is that? Acosta asks. The reason why is that your government doesn't want you to see and hear what they're doing in the United States of America. He goes on to tweet in this Twitter storm today, "The United States of America should respect the freedom of the press. You know that freedom? It's in the Constitution. What would the GOP say if Hillary Clinton were to shut down the cameras in the briefing room and the media went along with it?" Well, the Trump White House's new restrictions on press briefings is understandably receiving pushback from broadcast journalists and marks a very new and, I would say, troubling moment for secrecy by a presidential administration. Executive branch secrecy in and of itself is hardly new, and it's been used to keep the public for years under administrations both Republican and Democratic in the dark about key government policies and findings. While folks like Jim Acosta and CNN largely point cameras at government officials and tell the public whatever they say, whether it's a lie or not, it's largely left to print journalists to do the real digging into stuff that the government does not want you to know about. And those journalists have to do it through tools like the Freedom of Information Act, which often takes years, court cases, a whole lot of money, and a whole lot of persistence in order to effectively shake out government secrets into the public realm. Those efforts, of course, are often made even more difficult by government classification of documents. Many call it overclassification of documents, and many such documents are completely unknown to journalists at all, making it largely impossible for them to even seek Freedom of Information Act requests in the first place because they don't know what is there and, consequently, what our government is up to in secret. In many of those cases, it falls to whistleblowers like Bradley, now Chelsea Manning, to leak documents to the public so we have even a clue what our government is doing, supposedly on our behalf. That was the case with many of U.S. Army private and intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning's thousands of documents that she released concerning the Iraq and Afghanistan wars way back in 2010, including the infamous collateral murder video released by WikiLeaks. Remember that? And with footage of American Apache helicopters gunning down at least 10 men in Baghdad, including two Reuters journalists. The helicopter pilots also fired on a van that had stopped to help the wounded members of that first group that were gunned down by U.S. pilots. Two children in the van were wounded and their father was killed. Manning also released hundreds of thousands of U.S. diplomatic cables, which officials argued at the time had caused damage to national security and put U.S. troops and allies in great danger. Well, this week at BuzzFeed News, journalist Jason Leopold writes, "In the 7 years since WikiLeaks published the largest leak of classified documents in history, the federal government has said they caused enormous damage to national security. But a secret 107-page report prepared by a Department of Defense task force and newly obtained by BuzzFeed News tells a starkly different story. Here to describe that starkly different story told by the documents finally released under the Freedom of Information Act after years of persistence is Jason Leopold, our friend. He is an investigative journalist, formerly at Vice News, now at BuzzFeed News. He's the author of the LA Times bestseller News Junkie, a memoir. But of course, he is probably far better known these days by the description used for him by one of the government agencies on the receiving end of his many Freedom of Information Act requests. They called him a FOIA terrorist, a name that I believe he now proudly wears, and as well he should, given all of the otherwise secret government information that we pay for, by the way, that he has unearthed and uncovered through FOIA requests and court cases meant to enforce them. Jason spent many years covering the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center, as well as government whistleblowers like Chelsea Manning and much more. Jason Leopold, welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Great to be back with you, Brad. Thanks for having me on.
You bet. Listen, before we get to this damage assessment regarding those the Manning leaks that you were able to obtain, I know broadcast journalism isn't necessarily your beat, but I'm curious if you have thoughts on this White House, this new and really unprecedented effort to shut down, essentially, White House briefings, to keep cameras out of them. What's that about? And should we be concerned about that as you see it?
You know, I think in the just overall sort of picture about the fact that you have an administration that does operate under intense secrecy, that wants to limit access, right? Access being the key word there that journalists depend upon. Journalists who cover these briefings, journalists who travel with, various government officials, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. And the fact that, his recent trips, there was, I think, maybe a single journalist present, and in some cases, none at all.
Yeah.
Should we be concerned? I think that before I actually answer the question, let me say that it is important to have, you know, that type of access, you know, to ask questions, to pepper, you know, the press secretary with questions, to be able to confront our elected officials. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, however, you're not going to get anything out of that. You know, at this point, it's almost more of a sideshow. There's more interest in seeing, you know, Sean Spicer simply because of what he may say, and reactions by the media. But the public is not really going to gain any real, you know, insight into the administration's thinking simply by watching a press conference. You're not going to be able to confront any of these officials and then find out some deep, dark secret as a result.
No, you're not, but it does seem like it allows them to operate more in secret. This works out well for them. To not be confronted. I mean, when we look at your work, Jason, sometimes it takes years and years to get at this information. And I know that's not necessarily what comes out in a White House press briefing. But, you know, we often don't have years and years to wait for some of this information. And we've heard for years, for example, when it comes to these leaks from whistleblowers like Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden and so forth, about the loss of lives that will come from the disclosures. But the government rarely, if ever, is forced, you know, to actually detail those dangers. And I know that was the case certainly with the Manning leaks. And now that she was sentenced to 35 years in Leavenworth for those disclosures, seven of which she served. Before her sentence was mercifully commuted last year by President Obama. Well, so now we finally have, all of these years later, we have this damage assessment that, the government officials have been referring to for so many years. Is that essentially what this Defense Department report is about, the damage that was caused by those leaks?
That's exactly what it is. And let me just, before I get into this, let me just say a note about, you know, the press briefing and the access. Access is really important. It's really important to confront government officials. So I don't want my comments or my remarks to be taken downplaying the importance of that.
Mm-hmm.
That's really important. It's really important that Jim Acosta you know, raised awareness about it. And it's important that, you know, government officials are held to account. And in some cases, you know, that's what's noteworthy about those briefings. With regard to this Defense Department report, let me put this into context, mm-hmm. because this is really, really important. And over the past couple of days, I've seen some really passionate responses to this damage assessment. First, let me just say it's an 107-page report. Half of that report was withheld.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the government withheld it under a number of different FOIA exemptions. In addition to that, they redacted numerous pages. So ultimately what I was left with was 35 pages of heavily redacted material about this so-called damage that resulted from the leaks. What we can take out of this report, this final report,
mm-hmm.
written in June, in 2011, I think it was June 2011, I don't have it in front of me, mm-hmm. but it was 1 year after the leaks were published.
Right.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And 1 year after the leaks were published, the Defense Department assessed that there was no real impact, negative impact, to U.S. interests. And they say that,
mm-hmm.
U.S. interests. No impact to U.S. interests or the strategic impact to operations in Afghanistan or Iraq. It does note that it had the potential, could cause potential harm,
right.
for Afghans, Iraqis, interpreters, intelligence sources. Again, potential harm 1 year after. So they didn't assess that. Ultimately, there was no damage. There was, you know, they realized that the damage, if there was any damage that was done, it had no real impact on, you know, what our purpose was or what our goal was.
Mm-hmm.
What they were concerned about in some cases were, as you know, these leaks revealed a real ugly side of the wars.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the civilian casualties that were unreported,
mm-hmm.
and the concern that the Defense Department had, as they note in this report, was that the press, the media, would use these revelations to undermine the U.S. war effort in those countries. So that was a big concern that they had. But ultimately,
that's a political concern. That's not a life or death concern, as they seem to be arguing at the time.
Right. And it does say, again, potential harm to, mm-hmm. you know, the lives of the Afghan population.
Mm-hmm.
But what's really important, you know, the reason I'm saying this is that what's been missed in you know, some of the commentary revolving around this is that this was the final report of this so-called Information Review Task Force, this task force that was set up by the Defense Department to review all of the documents leaked to WikiLeaks. They did a line-by-line review. 20 different government agencies, including the NSA, the FBI, the CIA, Department of Homeland Security, to review all of the documents.
Mm-hmm.
And they prepared a number of different reports, and this was the final report. And in this final report, a year after the leaks, they didn't say that, look, you know, there were a number of deaths,
mm-hmm.
Innocent lives that were lost as a result of this. They were saying that, hey, look, you know, in some cases, some of the documents that were leaked really were no big deal. They actually say that. So,
and this was in regard, for example, just pulling out a quote or two here from the hundreds of thousands of Iraq-related military documents and State Department cables concerning Iraq. The report assesses, quote, with high confidence that disclosure of the Iraq data set will have no direct personal impact on current and formal U.S. leadership in Iraq. I mean, that's sort of saying right then and there, for at least for the Iraq effort, that, hey, this no damage at all concerning Iraq. They seem to be a little more cautious when it came to Afghanistan, saying it would not result in significant impact to U.S. operations, but did have that potential to cause serious damage to intelligence sources and so forth. Is it possible, Jason Leopold, that The worst damage, the worst assessment was in those redacted portions. I think more of the document was redacted than released. Yeah?
I doubt it. I doubt that you will, that those redacted pages contain anything about, the terrible damage that mm-hmm. resulted. I think that those redacted pages more or less dealt with, military plans and operations that even though were already known from the release of the material, we're still, the government still deemed it classified, and that's why they redacted it when they gave it to me. Despite mm-hmm. the fact that this was publicly released, it was classified. Look, the serious damage, if there was any real serious damage that resulted from those leaks, you could be sure that would have resulted in the first year, mm-hmm. right? If not less,
right.
Then that the leaks were published. But that's why I wanted to note that this report was written 1 year after the leak.
Right.
So there was nothing there that said it. They're still talking potential damage. Perhaps they're worried that, potential damage would result later on down the road. But we have not heard about it yet. And, this is this so-called threat to national security that resulted, or that the government claims resulted, was used in the trial of the court-martial of Chelsea Manning.
Yeah.
So that came up quite a bit, and they were referencing this particular report and others like it.
Mm-hmm.
So, here we are, as I noted in the story, 7 years later, and we haven't heard anything. I mean, there's nothing that, that we've been able to stand up. And I think largely because, a lot of the material dealt with, casualties previously unreported casualties in Iraq and Afghanistan. The State Department cables may have, I will say this, I think that the State Department cables, the damage that it caused was probably embarrassment. Mm. To the U.S. government based on what was being discussed.
Mm-hmm.
There may have been some lives that were threatened. Again, I don't know if that's in any of the redacted pages there.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, they're more or less saying here, hey, look, we can still operate much in the same way that we had been operating in Iraq and Afghanistan before these leaks took place, we'll have to monitor if the leaks, would end up causing any harm to, the Afghan population. But when you look at an assessment, when you look at a report that the government prepares, like, such as this,
yeah.
they have to put in that, what is the potential damage? There's the damage, and mm-hmm. then there's the potential damage. So they have to assess that, and that was just their assessment. And if there was anything sort of backed up,
mm-hmm.
saying, "Look, lives were just lost here. A number of innocent civilians or informants were killed." I doubt that's in any of the redacted pages.
Well,
a report.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say, you would think that that the most damaging information like that, without revealing sources and methods, that they would want to get that out. The government would have an interest in making sure that was unredacted when these documents were released. Did you?
Absolutely. And that's why I said, that's why, when I look at the passion,
yeah.
the passionate responses by people, I've experienced this when I wrote a similar report about Snowden. There was a damage assessment that I obtained via FOIA on the Snowden leaks.
Right.
And, excuse me, it was, the damage there was deemed to be far more catastrophic
mm-hmm.
Than the damage here. And a lot of this is just, it ends up just being embarrassment. And I know it's very difficult for people to believe it, but there also gets down to sometimes a couple of camps where you feel that, you either love Edward Snowden, you love what Chelsea Manning did, or you hate them. And so sometimes it's hard to separate that. And sometimes people have a real hard time understanding that, look, you could release a trove of classified material and perhaps it will benefit our adversaries. in terms of what the damage is, you know, what mm-hmm. ultimately happened as a result, sometimes it's just not there. Maybe it meant they lost some sources, informants no longer wanted to work as informants. But as you read that, you know, that particular, those two sort of quotes that you took out of the, mm-hmm. The report there, you know, no strategic impact on U.S. operations in Afghanistan, and it really didn't undermine anything in Iraq are important takeaways.
Jason Leopold, you said you got a lot of passionate response. Passionate response in what sense? People who were angry that you released this document? People who were still angry at Manning? What was the response you got?
I should say the response was certainly, you know, anger at Manning still, but it was anger at the sort of framing, the way in which I framed the story, that there was no real harm, people felt that there must be some harm. And certainly, look, you release 700,000 pages of classified records. Mm-hmm. Of course, there's going to be some sort of harm in the sense of, you know, how it harms the government, in the sense that they didn't have very good security. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, security. I mean,
as far as the access to information and the possibility that can be leaked. But even there, you would think they probably learned something from this, and they have probably hardened their system since. I mean, we saw that whistleblower recently, the NSA contractor, Reality Winner, who released documents regarding the 2016 election, and boy, they had her arrested the next day, it seems like.
Right.
So, you know, they may have put new safeguards in charge, in place, thanks to some of these previous leaks, in any event. Very quickly, there's a few other things I want to get to here, Jason. How long did it take you to get this document out from the government?
So this was I think 2.5 years it took to get this report, and it was only because it actually grew out of my lawsuit, a federal FOIA lawsuit that I had against the same agency, mm-hmm. When I obtained the Snowden documents. So when I obtained the Snowden damage assessment documents, there was an explanation about this task force, and it was explained in records that I received that this task force that was set up to assess the damage from Snowden grew out of the WikiLeaks task force that was set up to assess the damage out of the release of documents by WikiLeaks. So I didn't really know that, you know, that it existed. And when we found out that they were putting together similar reports, you know, filed a Freedom mm-hmm. of Information Act request and then sued the government to obtain it. So it took quite a while to get those records.
And that's one of the...
Two years is a long time.
2 years is a long time. And but that, you know, that's one of the points I made there in the opening, that a lot of times journalists don't even know what to request because we don't know what exists. Which, by the way, you know, might go back to the other original point concerning those White House briefings. Sometimes they say stuff that I know has led you and others to say, "Oh, really? Let me submit a FOIA on that to get more details."
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So that's
absolutely yes.
Another downside of hiding the White House briefings in that fashion.
True, and you know, it's important. I'm someone who believes passionately myself in transparency and open government, and that's the antithesis of that. You know what they're trying to do. I think that would also extend to Congress. I don't know if you recall, mm-hmm. A couple of weeks ago they were trying to say that reporters were not allowed to conduct interviews or film lawmakers going through the hallways of
right.
Congress, which is just ludicrous. So, you know, this type of behavior kind of trickles down to various levels within the federal government. And let's face it, it also goes into the local and state governments as well. This intense secrecy, mm-hmm. where elected officials who are accountable to the people are simply not interested in speaking, and then try and set up some new rules that basically, bars the press from confronting them.
A fish rots from the head down, as they say. And I know that, speaking of Congress, a couple of colleagues of yours over at BuzzFeed reported a few weeks ago as well that a House committee had tried. This was actually the Committee on Financial Services had told the Treasury Department to decline FOIA requests relating to communications between those offices. And this is a case where you've got a Congress, in case people don't understand, you've got Congress, which is essentially exempt. They have exempted themselves from the FOIA rules. And they're trying to say that communications with an executive agency, which are covered by FOIA, that those communications themselves should be exempt because they include the communications with Congress. That seems new and troubling. Am I understanding that correctly, Jason?
Yes, you nailed it. I mean, that's exactly what they're doing, and they're essentially trying to block the release of any records. And in a sense, one of the great things about FOIA is that, yes, as you noted, Congress is exempt, but I can actually go around Congress and go to a government agency that is subject to FOIA and say, I want all your communications with this particular committee or this particular member of Congress. And so what they're trying to do is saying, hey, we don't give you permission or you're prohibited from releasing any of those communications to anyone who requests it. That is new. It's incredibly troubling. It's just another sign, an example of the intense government secrecy that we're starting to see.
And are you seeing, because I know you faced a lot of frustration, even under Democratic administrations, under Obama, trying to shake loose some of these documents. Are you noting a specific marked difference in the responses now under this new administration than you were under the Obama administration to your FOIA requests?
Yes, I would say that it feels a bit more difficult right now to obtain records. I have to say there's a part of the reason that exists is because there's still this massive backlog that these agencies are contending with from years past and the previous administration. But it feels as if it's going to be a huge battle to pry loose records out of this administration, to pry loose records out of the agencies in response to whatever the administration is doing or whatever they're undertaking. So I'm already starting to see that. Look, I asked for, like others have, the memo and memos that James Comey wrote and was leaked to the New York Times about his interactions with Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. Now, he disclosed this. He disclosed this memo. He indicated that one was unclassified. And just by the fact that he disclosed it should automatically make it subject to FOIA. And the fact that it's classified and he spoke about it means it should be subject to FOIA and it should be released. But the FBI is saying that it's part of an ongoing law enforcement investigation. That is true. That's what they said to me last week when I received a letter from them. But again, this unclassified memo that has already been characterized and discussed should be disclosed. That one can make an argument. Well, it is part of a law enforcement investigation. Sure, but in other instances, I'm seeing again some intense secrecy. Look, just a few minutes ago, Brad, I tweeted out a letter I received from the Justice Department about Trump's transition, right? I asked for transition documents. Sometimes transition documents, by the way, can be really helpful to gain an understanding of how an agency, what an agency is doing, how they're changing, what their plans are. A division within or a component within the Justice Department said, hey, we have 789 pages, but we're withholding 789 pages. We'll give you some, but we're going to withhold 789 pages under a certain exemption. So it's difficult, and I think some of these agencies are really having trouble trying to figure out how to respond to requests, largely because you have a president now who is tweeting, who is arguably, you know, declassifying,
right,
instantly declassifying information that would otherwise, you know, remain secret.
He's piercing the veil of secrecy when he talks about these documents that then should give you and us as the American people and as journalists the right to look at what it is that he is actually referring to. You know, when it comes to things like the Comey memo, sure, there's an investigation, but it's also not a classified document. It's also, you know, been discussed. We shouldn't have to wait for years to see it. It's certainly of public interest, no question about it. But, you know, with this government, and this has gone on for a long time, you know, they withhold information that is certainly not the part of, you know, part of an investigation. You've got a story yesterday at BuzzFeed. Just to lighten things up before we go, I'll just point folks over to BuzzFeed.com. You and David Mack, a document revealing that a bunch of CIA staffers were fired for stealing snacks from vending machines. And I note that this happened 4 years ago, and we're only hearing about it now. So if they're willing to keep that kind of nonsense secret, I can only imagine what else they're trying to keep secret. Jason, I hope you will continue to force them to not keep these things secret as much as possible. Jason Leopold.
I'm going to try my darndest. Thank you, Brad.
Keep at it, brother. Jason Leopold, you can find his work at BuzzFeed.com, and you can and should follow him on the Twitters at Jason Leopold. Thanks, Jason. Always great talking to you, my friend.
Thanks, Brad. Appreciate it.
Okay, when we return, we will take Donald Trump's bait very quickly, his big, dumb, stupid tweet today. I'm Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast. Yeah, well, too late for the President of the United States. Talk about American idiots. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. All right, well, we didn't take Desi Doyen. We didn't take the bait earlier of this tweet that Donald Trump put out just really minutes after the Republicans had released their House plan, health plan in the Senate
today.
I'm
sure the timing of that release had nothing to do with the really awful bill and the awful press that the Republicans are getting right now.
Right, exactly. It came out, I think it was about 15 minutes later. The bill was getting slammed after it was finally released. This is the health care bill in the Senate. And then, of course, Donald Trump comes out with this tweet and all of the media look the other way. Oh, my God, Donald Trump is tweeting about the supposed tapes that he suggested he might have had, the audio tapes of his meetings with now fired FBI Director Jim Comey. He tweeted, of course, "I have no idea whether there are tapes or recordings of my conversations with James Comey, but I did not make and do not have any such recordings," says Donald Trump.
Wait, "I do not know, but I don't have"? So he doesn't know?
Well, he doesn't know if somebody else may have. Yeah, the first part of the tweet, he was talking about all this electronic surveillance. So maybe someone else has tapes, but he doesn't have any such recordings. You'll recall that he had said after news of the meeting between Trump and Comey, where Trump was pressuring him to end the investigation into former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, that meeting in the Oval Office, Trump came out and said, "Better hope there are no tapes of our conversations." And so there was questions. Did he have a Oval Office taping system? Now he says, he claims he does not, and everyone is reporting it as if there are no tapes. Do you believe him?
Absolutely not.
I know.
We all know, as has been proven many times, there was that deposition that he had to go under oath, and they discovered that, he admitted 30 times he lied in previous cases against him. So if he's willing to lie publicly about those things back in the past.
Under oath.
Well, he wasn't lying under oath at that time.
He was
admitting in this deposition that he had lied all these other times. So I think it's fairly clear that he's very likely to lie when speaking publicly and not under
oath. He's a liar. He lies all the time. And so I think when the media just take him at his word that there are no tapes, as opposed to him having tapes and having destroyed them, I think they're falling for it. I don't think they should settle for it. Congressman Adam Schiff, who's the ranking member of the U.S. House Intelligence Committee, he doesn't seem to be falling for it. At least he's saying that a tweet is not good enough.
Right.
They have asked for his response to Congress as far as whether any tapes exist. He has requested them. And he is still waiting for them, for the White House to answer that response, whether or not any tapes or recordings exist.
Or had existed,
right. That these purported White House recordings, that they now don't exist, says Schiff, raises as many questions as it answers. He says, while I would certainly hope that the president's most recent statement is true, we will continue to pursue the matter with other witnesses, so that the public can be assured that if recordings were ever made, they will be preserved and be made available to the committee and ultimately to the public as well. It would be illegal for him to delete those tapes. The Presidential Records Act, put in place after the Watergate scandal, says that any such tapes are part of that presidential record and cannot be deleted. And while Donald Trump can go out and say anything he wants on Twitter, he's not under oath there. He can lie as much as he wants. He cannot lie to Congress. So we will see if the White House responds there to Adam Schiff's ongoing request for those tapes. But for now, at least Donald Trump says he did not have any such tape recordings. He's a liar or a bluffer, depending on how you look at it. Either way, as David Frum over at The Atlantic says today, remember, David Frum is George W. Bush's former speechwriter, so he knows liars well. Foreign adversaries, he says, will take note, and they're more likely to ignore Trump's threats and his promises in the future because now they see that he is a bluffer or a liar. Take your pick. So that all matters, I guess. And of course, if you didn't know that he was a bluffer or a liar by now, I'm not sure what planet you're living on. All right, I got to get out. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to my guest today, Jason Leopold of BuzzFeed News, and to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program or any other, download it for free anytime at bradblog.com. While you're there, we thank those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate to help us continue to do what we try to do on the air here every day. You can find, follow, and share us worldwide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at The Brad Blog. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.